Hi, you're listening to Scribble Talk, an SMA exclusive sponsored podcast from our friends at SMA. My name is Bhaskar Sundaram, and with my co-host Ashley Case, we will be sitting down with our SMA colleagues to share their stories, discuss their career, and learn how they are making an impact in the industry. Today's guest is Jacques Keats. As the Chief Operating Officer at SMA, Jacques has spent the past 12 years creating a work environment that ensures the world's best talent can focus on what they do best. As a software engineer, he is recognized in industry as expert in the field of system design and integration for project management and developing and implementing award-winning scheduling, resource planning, costing, and enterprise project management systems for Fortune 500 companies and government agencies, including direct responsibility for bringing 5 commercial software applications, the SMA Talent on Demand, Tracker, iPursuit, iPortfolio, and Traction, to market with cumulative revenues over $50 million. Jacques also has received industry and government awards for successful project management and earned value systems implementation, including recognition from Brookhaven National Labs, Xerox, Boeing, National Missile Defense Program, Navy, and Army. Wow. Jacques has interest in software development and electronics, and his hobbies include sailing, golfs, and cars and motorcycles. Jacques, there is so much to talk about you. Welcome to Scribble Talk. Great to have you with us, Jacques.
Thank you, Bhaskar.
Jacques, let's start from the very beginning. Where were you born and your high school and education?
So I was born in Southern California. Initially grew up in the Santa Monica, Pacific Palisades area, and then my folks moved us out to a little city called Covina, where I really spent most of my formative years. And I went to a high school in Covina, a little high school, public school called Royal Oak, and then went on to my postgraduate work.
All around California, Jacques?
Yeah, everything I did was in California. I went to Mount San Antonio College and got an AA degree in information technologies. And then I went to Cal State Fullerton and got a degree in computer science.
Information technology and computer science 25 years ago, Jacques, how was it?
It was interesting, actually. It was the wild, wild west. It wasn't considered an engineering discipline at the time, and was there was a lot of opportunity at that time. In fact, I was able to start a company before I graduated from college, and a lot of my colleagues considered our first product Tracker as my senior project.
Wow, you're an entrepreneur even before you finished your graduation. That's typical American story, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. It was certainly a lot easier to do then, I think, than perhaps even now, because it was the microcomputers were new. They were kind of the Vaxes and Primes were new, and the PC was just emerging, and that created all kinds of opportunities.
I normally ask these questions at the very end, but let me drop it now. Do you think world would be a better place if the computers didn't exist?
I don't think so personally. I think that, it's allowed us to become closer ultimately. Mm. If you think about how small the world is today from the perspective of the internet, we're all closer. For me, having friends, in another state was considered interesting, right? Today, my kids have friends all over the world that they're very close to, people that they stay in contact with, and as do I, which is something that without the advent of the computer wouldn't have been possible.
So when you were at university and school, Jacques, what was the coolest technology that was available?
I would say probably an Apple IIe was kind of the cool thing. I had terminals that I logged in, that I sat on my desk at home and I logged into the computer labs with. It was those kinds of things.
Got you. So after successful entrepreneurship at your just around finishing up university, Jacques, how did your career kick started?
So I got very fortunate, and it's really, my career has been very opportunistic. I was in a marketing class of all things, and the professor said that there was a small company right by the university that was looking for basically an intern to help in the marketing department. I thought, you know, it'd probably be a good idea to go at least interview and be a part of the, you know, at least get some experience with this. I was at that time, I think maybe a sophomore, in my sophomore year of college. And I went down there, I was sitting in the lobby and realized they're a software company. And I interviewed and eventually got a position there, and then started trying to find a way to get into the software development part of the company. So that's where I actually met the people that we started Decker Limited with, and whereas it was able to launch my career, you know, both to get experience starting off in, as an intern and becoming the lead developer in the special applications group, and then moving on to develop a whole company.
How long were you there, Jacques, and what was your next move from there?
Yeah, so I got to Sysdynetics in 1981, and we started Decker in 1984. And I was at, we had Decker for 26 years. And then I through acquisition joined SM&A.
26 years, successful career, Jacques. And is that what brought you into the proposal field post acquisition of SM&A?
No, actually we had had the opportunity to work with SM&A much, much earlier than that. You know, probably starting in, I'm guessing it was in the early 80s. We were one of our first clients, a company called Environmental Systems Research Institute, and a partner company called Tetra Tech, were pursuing a large federal acquisition for mapping the world. And they brought us on board to help them with their programmatics, to help position them to, to represent that they could actually manage a program of that scope. And SM&A was involved in helping them with the proposal at that time. That was probably about 86. And I had opportunities to work with SM&A on the NMD program. Again, we were running programmatics. You know, it's one of the things that I think is probably underrated in terms of, its importance to proposals is the whole architecture of the program itself, the IMP, the IMS, the how you're going to manage the program, the earned value components of it. And that was really what our areas of specialty were. So we got brought in often to help with, represent that in proposals for clients that we were already supporting.
Wow. So 1986, I might ask you a dumb question here, Jacques. What's an earned value management?
Excellent. So it was really a management methodology that was born out of large acquisition programs that occurred in the 50s. And the biggest challenge that most organizations have is that they know they're always looking in the rearview mirror. And earned value is a discipline that allows you to predict. It's more predictive. Based on your performance, it allows you to see, to predict the outcome of a program through metrics. And most importantly, what it allows you to do is not only see what you spent, but be able to assess the value you got for what you spent. And that a little helps you identify really whether or not you're on a trajectory to come in on schedule, on cost, and on budget.
Wow, Jacques. I think that, you know, we might need to have a separate session on this at some point, but who might know earned value management? Here we go. I asked the definition. So the rest of it, Google it, or we'll have a separate session on that. So from then on, Jacques, I think 1986, some touch points with SM&A and post-acquisition. When was the acquisition happened, Jacques, and when did you officially enter SM&A?
Yeah, so I got to SM&A in 2007. November of 2007. So it was, getting close to the end of the year. And, initially brought in the whole process was intended to bring value to the firm. SM&A at that time had bought six companies. They had bought a planning scheduling company, an earned value company. They bought an engineering company.
basically an IT services company, and they were having challenges gluing all that together. So I migrated from being responsible for just leading the earned value team to being involved in actually helping with the integration of all of these different companies. But we were able to get the team put together and get it to be cohesive. And today that is what represents our program services group, which is about 50% of the revenue of the company.
I think this is the right time to talk about SMA, Joachim. What is SMA and what does SMA do?
So we regard ourselves as a full program lifecycle consulting firm. And what that means really is that we start very left of the proposal, of the RFP itself. And we work with clients to develop market strategies. We work with clients to determine, you know, what markets to play in, what products and services to bring to those markets, who's playing, what are the opportunities, how do you position in that market? A lot of strategy consulting in that part of what we do. That feeds our capture business, and it also feeds our competitive assessment price to win activities, which is really the front end to our proposal support. And all of that represents about half the business. And then from there, once clients win, often they bring us back or they have us come in and help with a variety of post-award support, which could be earned value, could be planning, scheduling. There's a number of compliance activities that go on, here in the U.S. as well as in the U.K. and other parts of the world around, how you have to execute on a program once you've been awarded, and the kinds of reporting that you have to do. We help clients with those things, and then we have a lot of staffing activities post award in engineering and program management.
Wow, that's a complete end-to-end lifecycle support. The history of SMA, York, when was SMA started to where it is now?
So SMA started in 1982. Steve Myers started the company with a very accurate belief of being in a position to look at a proposal very differently. And Steve applied system engineering methodologies to proposals, which means that you decompose the requirements and then you build up to an end item product, which in this case is the proposal itself. And Steve Myers, as well as Steve Shipley, were the catalyst to the industry that we all support and love to work in today. Mm. And although there's some differences in the methodologies, there's a lot of similarities. And it helped develop that industry. SM&A took a little bit of a different tack in that what we did is really more tactical. We were on the ground helping clients with the day-to-day activities of pursuing, winning, and performing on programs. And oftentimes part of what we did for clients was to bring in subject matter experts, people with unique capabilities, people with unique perspectives, and a lot of times people who were very adept or expert in unique things like earned value or program management or planning and scheduling. And when the programs completed, often, or when the programs are awarded, oftentimes they would ask our people to stay on and help get the program started up. And that's really how we built out our post-award services.
Wow, Chuck. And so Ajay came on the board after 2007, Chuck. Any fond memories of working alongside Ajay in the early stages of consolidating and bringing the new identity of SMA as it stands today?
Yeah, so, the SMA, like many firms, has, evolved over time. And it got to its peak in 2008. I had, a fantastic year. And then, of course, there's some challenges in the economy, starting in 2000, really starting in 2007, but it impacted the firm in about 2010. Mm-hmm. And I think, in some regards, in trying to address that, the firm lost its way a little bit. The firm started looking more like its customers, like the Lockheeds and Northrops, as opposed to more of a consulting firm and being as more agile. So when AJ came in, one of the unique things about AJ is he's got a very strategic methodology to things. And, you know, he came in with a plan and then made a lot of adjustments to that plan as he lifted up the hood and got to see under, how things were actually working, and made a lot of changes. I will tell you that there were a lot of preconceived notions of things that, you know, if you change this, the whole house of cards will fall apart. And AJ, we had no fear in making changes to anything that needed to change. And I think that courage was, what the firm needed at the time, certainly, and allowed us to eliminate obstacles that had been barriers to success from the firm for quite a while. There were a variety of things. The idea that we had to have, a single handler for deploying people to a lot of manual process in the back office. And we completely, we skewered a lot of sacred cows, and we moved through the process of actually bringing the firm to, our current state, which is very nimble, very agile, as well as, highly automated, and everything, we completely digitally enabled end to end the entire firm, over that journey.
Wow, that final word, Jacques, makes it very interesting, digitally enabled. I think that kind of nicely brings us to Todd, Jacques. So what's Todd, Jacques, and why, and what does it actually do?
So, Todd is really what I would call a talent management system. We often refer to it as an ERP, and I think it's ultimately evolving into that as we integrate a number of components like time cards and expense reporting and HR attributes into the platform. But the core of Todd really is to create a past performance for talent. If you look at a resume, any resume, there at best it's terrible. And the reason I say that is that most resumes talk about what company you worked for, what title do you have at that company, and what responsibilities did you have in that role. And the problem with that is it doesn't really tell the reader what you did, what your value add was, or any of those attributes effort that you contributed to. What was your value add? What did you contribute? And as such, it really creates, it leaves a big gap. So what we did is we wanted to create a past performance capability, something that talked about what role did you have on that project? What value did you bring to the project in that role? And in essence, kill the resume. And with Todd, that's really what we've done. If you take any resume and you put it into the platform, you'll get about 30% of the information that we actually collect in Todd. The rest of it has to come from your project history, what you've actually done, and it's objective past performance. And that, in essence, is really what Todd is. It's been an interesting journey for us. We started off building Todd as an internal system to help basically generate resumes. And it evolved from there to what we have today, which is really a capability that not only is it used by our operations group, but it's used by our sales team to get to identify the right talent based on inputs they get from the clients. And it's also used by clients to self-serve and source talent. And one of the key tenets we had for the system was complete transparency, being in a position to make sure that our associates know what the body of work is that they can be considered for, and that our clients know exactly the capabilities and talents of the individual, their past performance, and what rates, what's their availability, a lot of things that the consulting companies don't do well.
Yes, Jacques. So If we kind of take a step back, Jock, and then carve it out as before and after, so before Todd, after Todd, from the perspective of the customer who is actually, you know, requesting resources, before Todd, what happens? After Todd, now how their life is transformed?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. So before Todd, what would happen is a client would have a need. They would reach out to one of our BD people. That person would ask them a series of questions about what the need was, interpret that information, then call back to headquarters and provide their interpretation of that information. One of the handlers, and you know, it was a role I had at one point in SM&A, which was to then be intimate with all of the talent, know who's in your pool, know who, what their capabilities are, and then interpret the interpreted information that you got from the BD person and decide who you think they should put forward. And we would send them a couple of resumes, and they would take that to the client. The client would say, well, it's not exactly what I need. And this would go back and forth several times before we got to an answer that was appropriate for the client. And it took a lot of energy. It took a lot of time and wasn't very efficient. And we had five, what we call practice leads, each one doing this for a different segment of the business. What Todd allowed us to do is put the body of work, that past performance I was talking about, in the hands of our BD people, and they could sit right there with the client and say, so you need somebody with aircraft experience, and get a list of aircraft experience. And well, they need to be a proposal manager, get a list of proposal managers with aircraft experience. They need to have worked on Army aircraft, again, limiting this down and being able to do a quick compare of individuals to get to the best person based on the things that the client thought were important, and give the client the visibility to make some trade-offs on their own. So instead of two levels of indirection to some of these trade-offs occurring, the client was intimately involved in saying, well, I think aircraft experience is probably more important than Army aircraft experience. And this person has got a huge body of work that they've done across the aircraft development space and so on. And it allows the client to be more choiceful about this. To give you an example, we had a client that we had worked with. They had called up, they needed 25 people for a job. This was pre-Todd. We spent the better part of 4 weeks, and it was four of us, spent the better part of 4 weeks sourcing resumes, sending resumes back and forth, calling people for availability, looking at the trade-offs and working with the client. And we trickled people into the client over that four-week period, which ate up part of the time to get the proposal working, because they called us when the draft hit the streets. That same client, although the client won, that same client, when there was a recompete, came back and said, we're going after this again. We need 25 more people. This was now probably 4 or 5 years later. And they called us on a Thursday afternoon. They gave us the list of people they wanted. Thursday night, about 2 hours later, we had a short list of 30 people. We went through that with the client the next morning. So Friday morning, we got down to the list of 25. Monday morning, we had 25 people standing in their lobby, ready to start work. And that's what Todd has done for SM&A and for our clients.
Look, like all the bottlenecks that involved on A, finding resource, A, B, managing resource, and onboarding resources all being kind of cluttered out massively by Todd Jock. Is that right?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the challenges that, you know, that any services firm has, particularly if you're working with a variety of different projects, you don't know if that project that the person's assigned to is really going to end when you think it's going to end. It could extend, it could end early. And managing all of that dynamics just around availability can be challenging. And then you've got the human factors of people that get to the end of a job and want to take 2 weeks off to vacation with their family or just to recharge their batteries. And so there's a lot of fun, you know, there's a lot that goes into getting, not only getting the right person, but getting the right person who's available at the time you need them to be available.
100%, Jacques. Looks like the workflow has been thought through really well on how the whole thing works. Version one of Todd, you know, what kind of triggered the development of Todd? What was there in version one? And fast forward now, what version do we have? And in future, what's our plans?
Right. So version one of Todd was really the talent portal, which gave us the ability to collect the information for the user's profile and to create a resume, shortly followed by the ability to actually do search across that data set. And then from there, we built out a portal for our BD organization to do searching and then clients. Right now, we're in Rev, I think 1.20 is probably about where we are. We're working on the 2.0 UI because now that we've got this beautiful engine that's does the things we need it to do, we want to go back and in essence upgrade the upholstery, make it easier, a little easier to use, a little more intuitive. But with software, it's a continually evolution. You know, as soon as you get done with something, you can think of 10 things you'd do to make it better.
100% job. Looks like we can keep talking about Todd for the rest of the hour, but let's
move. Yeah. You know, I'll tell you the one thing about Todd that's different than anything else I've ever, any other software product I've ever done is there's always an educational process with clients with most software. You've got to, you know, show them the value of it and convince them why they would want to use it. With Todd, it's been the complete opposite. As soon as somebody sees it, they want to use it and they get it. We've developed something here that sounds trite, but sells itself not because because it's got some kind of, you know, flash and whatnot. It sells itself because it really solves a problem and does it in a very intuitive way that people just get. And it's really fun to go to clients and show them the application because they immediately are nodding their heads. They immediately want to get access to it. We've got almost 7,000 people signed up on the platform just from a client perspective.
Wow. Todd, having access to Todd, Jacques, both as an associate and as a client, how can they do that?
So if you go to, the easiest way to do it is go to our public website, which is www.smawins.com. And there's right there on that main screen, there's an option to either join our team or hire the best talent in the world.
Got you. And that's the same portal for both client who wants to use it to find associates and for associates who want to be part of SMA to work with the clients. Is it the same?
So the it's one application, but based upon how your role and you can't, we don't allow people to be both client and associate. You can have a role in the platform. Once you sign up for a particular role, you have access to all the features associated with that, whether it's either the talent portal or the what we call the team builder portal.
100%, Jacques. So we will add that link part of the podcast episode so people can play with it. And I'm sure if anybody would like to have further discussions about Todd, Jacques, do you mind if I share your details?
Oh, that'd be fantastic. I'd love to do
that. Thank you, Jacques. So, Jacques, Dita, is it right that the APMP.org or APMP website was some hosting was owned by SMA for a long time?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that there's always been a passion at SMA, and honestly, I think this was driven by AJ during his first tour, to be technically forward, and we helped APMP develop their first website. We hosted that website actually on our servers for a period of time, and we just continued to maintain the domain. Every couple of years when the subscription occurred, we pay for it and keep the subscription going. they had all the access and rights and whatnot in terms of being able, you know, we had early on transitioned the management to site over to APMP, but we hung on to it. And at some point, I think when probably I'm guessing when Rick joined APMP, they realized that they didn't have the domain, and they reached out to us and asked us, you know, if we would transition that to them. And of course we did. But it was interesting. It was a surprise to actually many of us that had still been, you know, part of the domains we were maintaining and had been part of something that we had been a part of that way.
100%, Jock. I mean, like when I talk about the history of this whole podcast started to showcase the people behind the APMP and the contributions people have done. But that's one thing that when I learned that recently, I don't think anybody will be aware of that, but that's the SMA APMP connection and why we are talking about this today. So that's brilliant. So SMA has been a very strong supporter of APMP for a very long time, Jock. And from your time of starting 2007 till date, do you have any memorable experiences, including the BitCon where SMA used to have a very long presence as well?
Yeah, so the first experiences I had with SMNA actually started with the California chapter. Dick Eason is part of our leadership team at SMA and has been very, very active in APMP for a very long time, and introduced me specifically to APMP through the California chapter, and had a chance to meet a lot of great people. From a variety of different companies, and then we went to a couple of the bid and proposal con conferences, but I think probably the biggest memory that I have the most impactful memory I have is really the rollout of Todd. This was 2 years ago, I think, in Florida. We did a kind of a national rollout of Todd at that event. And it was, we put on a big splash, and it was incredible how well received we were and how welcoming Rick and his team was to the idea of doing that, as well as how the membership themselves were embraced what we were doing and the platform.
Got you. From here, York, I think your association with APMP and with California chapter in the recent APMP winning business virtual experience, the SMA Inspirations won the Palm Award for the Inspirations and Diversions from SMA. How did you feel about that? And that's a lot of effort to bring external guests inside for the one episode.
Well, first off, we had a lot of fun doing that. We were honored. I don't think it occurred to any of us that we would win a Palm Award or be recognized that way. We thought that one, we recognize the importance of this conference to the community, and to the association, and we wanted to be a part of that. And so we have been doing what we call our town halls, since COVID started. We felt it was important to maintain community. And since everybody was working virtually, we had to up our game. And we started off with, doing these daily tag ups, and then we expanded it to our entire body of associates. Every Thursday, we do a town hall. And as we started doing these, we were fearful that they would become stale. So we started thinking of new ways keeping them interesting, and we started bringing talent to those events. We brought a Broadway dancer, we brought a comedian, we brought magicians. We have somebody doing art history. We even have invented town hall trivia, and we thought that would be a great way to help keep this conference interesting to people and keep them engaged, give them a little bit of a break from some of the technical sessions. And allow them to hear a little bit about us, learn a little bit about an APMP through our town hall trivia, because we centered that all around, APMP, trivia around APMP, their history. And we had a lot of fun doing it, and it was very well received.
Yes, Jock, 100%. I was there myself And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And are we going to have one more SMA town hall where APMP members are going to join? Shock, is that right?
We are. I think that it was so well received that Rick and his team have offered to kind of co-host one of our town halls where we're going to open it up to the APMP membership. And we're going to bring, we're actually going to do it. It's a 90-minute segment that we're going to do. We're going to have a lot of entertainment and we're going to have a lot of fun. And it'll still be this similar format to what we do, you know, a little bit about the what's going on in the firm, a little bit about what's going on in industry, and a whole lot of fun.
Got you, Jacques. And I was the runner-up in your quiz competition for the Farm Award. Yeah. I'm definitely there. Definitely there. And listeners, please do join us on the September 10th, isn't it, Jacques? The invite will be coming out soon, I believe, from APMP.
That's great. Yes.
Jacques, we have talked a lot about professional career, SMA. So let's loosen up a bit, Jacques, and let's talk about you. Your hobbies, let's talk about hobbies, sailing. Are you an avid sailor? When did it all happen?
So that's actually a funny story. So I've always, since I was really, really little, boats just fascinated me to the point probably I drove my parents nuts about that. I mean, in the backyard, I turned, cardboard boxes into ships when I was very, very little. I mean, we're talking about 4 or 5 years old. And learn to sail, learn to navigate boats along the way. But I was Boy Scout. Here in Southern California, there's a camp on the Catalina Islands, and we had I'd been there for a summer, and had one of the diversions that they did is we did a canoe trip around the island and camped out in another location, and I found on the beach a rudder to a boat. And I left it there for a couple of days and nobody claimed it. And I took it home with me. And it was for a small sailboat. And when I got home, I basically started building a boat around that rudder, tiny boat. And I put it in my parents' swimming pool. And I learned to navigate in a small water space like that and took it out and actually had sailed it on several lakes. And then from there, got involved in bigger boats. And have, taken cruises down to Ensenada, many, many times back and forth to Catalina, up to the Bay Area. And have done a little bit of, racing as well.
Wow. And how long have you been sailing, Jacques, and any interesting memories?
I've been sailing, I'm guessing, for probably a little over 40 years. Certainly I was probably in my early teens when I really, started getting into sailing itself. Mm-hmm. I think probably some of the more interesting memories, really are when things don't go as planned. Getting caught in, we got caught in a very bad fog one day. We were sailing out, there's a small body of islands down in San Diego, right at the Mexican border. And we're going to sail out and go around those islands. And as we came around, we found ourselves in a very big fog, and, the weather got dicey out there. And, we ended up having to, take some measures to, make sure that, we got home. But it was a little bit exciting, a lot, very wet and, myself and the, my business partner at the time, was also a very avid sailor, managed the boat. We got back with the boat and with our, with everybody intact.
Exactly, Jacques. And if at all I come to California, you have to take me for a spin.
There you go. You got it.
Your golf, and I've never played golf, and I do know I need to try at some point. How it all began, and where are you in the golf level? They say something called caps and stuff, right? I can't even remember what those are.
So first off, I'm not a good golfer. I'm I love the game. I love playing, but I'm not really any good at it. In fact, when I growing up, our next door neighbor was belonged to a club, and he played golf every weekend. And, you know, every weekend would say, "You should come with me. I'll teach you how to play. This would be great." My cousin ended up being a landscape architect and working on one of the premier courses as their head designer for, you know, for the course. And I had, and he even tried to get me on. He had no interest in at Decker. Every year we did it. We did a themed user conference, and we'd have, you know, several thousand people show up to this conference, and we would do things to keep the people engaged and entertained in the event throughout the week. And we decided one year we were going to theme the event around golf. I was driving home one night and realized I don't play golf. I was probably at that point, I was in my mid 40s, I think, and realized I was going to have to learn how to play golf. So I started with the game very late, and with the objective of being able to hit one ball down the fairway while everybody was watching, and then get in the cart, drive off, and not worry about anybody seeing me hit, you know, take 10 shots to putt the ball in the hole. So, you know, because of the fact that we were, you know, I was a principal in the firm, the first flight off the, you know, off that morning was myself. Simon Decker was my business partner, and a couple of our members of our leadership team. And I ended up being the first person to drive off the tee. So fortunately, I practiced enough to get that ball to go straight down the fairway, which was the only straight shot I hit the entire day. But I do play. I like to get out. Occasionally AJ and I go out and play golf, and we have a good time with it. But it's a diversion. It's a nice way to be outside and, you know, clear your mind a little bit.
100%, Chuck, 100%. So, you know, if sailing is what gives you peace in the sea, looks like in the land, it's golf.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, the thing about sailing is that you can have a conversation like this on a sailboat, on a powerboat. You know, it's a lot of fun. They go fast. But they're loud, and you know, so they get you from point A to point B. With sailing, it's more of a journey. And I found that the things that give me most peace in this world are things that where you get to take a journey and experience the finer points of whatever it is you're doing along the way.
Wow, that's very powerful, Chuck. Very powerful. York, from being between sailing, golf, and developing softwares, you also have a passion in cars and motorcycles. Cars or motorcycles, which one began first, and how do you balance both?
Well, so, I grew up and my dad's an engineer, and he had started his career with Carroll Shelby as a machinist, then went to school, became an engineer, and at the end of his career, went to work for Carroll Shelby as his chief engineer. And so I grew up in a home where, you know, pulling in on a Friday night, pulling in, a radiator out of a car, repairing it, dropping it back in the car and going out on, you know, on a date was just normal. I probably learned to turn wrenches before I learned to write the alphabet. I started with motorcycles because that's kind of, you know, where you start. Or at least where I started. And, in fact, the first, motorbike that I got, didn't run, and I had, you know, I had taken it apart and figured out what was broken and went and got the parts I needed and, you know, and got it running. It was that kind of thing. I think that, there's, my grandfather was a machinist. My dad and his brother are both engineers. It was just a natural environment getting exposed to cars and motorcycles. And, I enjoyed riding, oftentimes I enjoy modifying and making them better, than I do in necessarily even riding or driving them.
Wow, Chuck. And do you have any memorable accidents that you're really proud of, Chuck?
Well, you know, I think that any accident is something that
you know, you're thankful that you get to walk away from. Probably there's a place where before we moved down to where we live today, there was we lived up in a kind of on the edge of a reserve, which was, I don't want to call it a mountain, but it was a mountain. And there was a road that led up and, you know, went down up one side of the city and down the other side of the city. And the kids liked to go up there and drift through that, through the turn at the top of that. And I had gone to get gas for my bike, decided I was going to, you know, make a turn through there. It takes about, I mean, it's not a big road. Probably it was no more than 20 minute ride. But I went up there, and as I came around the turn, a kid had dropped down on the wrong side of the road and was drifting through the turn coming right at me. And I laid the bike down he missed me. I missed him. But I ended up with some, you know, nicks and scratches. That was definitely one of those moments where I didn't think it was going to end the way it did.
Wow. That's so true, Jacques. I had a motorbike accident when I was a student in the university. But yeah, even now on the right leg, just on the other side of the knee, you know, if I run longer, like more than 5 kilometers, it started to give up slowly. Yeah. Because of the accident, I just went and spun down, hit the wall post there. And you can laugh about it now, but at that point, it wasn't funny.
No, and you know, my wife is an RN, and you know, so I came home and I didn't want anybody to notice it. So I was upstairs, you know, trying to get cleaned up and, you know, get the gravel out of the wounds. And my daughter noticed that I was doing that, and she, you know, said, "What happened to you?" And then of course my wife comes in and she's, you know, says, "Let me help you with that." You know, so, you know, I got chastised a little bit because, you know, she's seen a lot of motorcycle accidents that unfortunately didn't end as well as the one that I had.
Jock, now officially we open what we call the Nutters Round in honor of Howard Nutt. It used to be called Random Rapid Fire Questions. Now, you know, short random questions just to get more about you, Jock. So tell us the three things not many people know about you.
Three things that many people don't know about me. Probably the biggest is that I'm dyslexic. So, you know, I learned very early in life that I have to work very, very hard to make sure that, you know, that I don't write things backwards as well as I don't read them backwards. Not allowing that to get in the way. The other is I'm extremely mechanically inclined. I think that's the reason why I like cars and motorcycles. And even as a young kid, before I could drive, you know, buddies in high school would bring their cars by, you know, to put in stereo systems or alarm systems, or, you know, particularly electronics, because that was something I could visually see. And the last one would be that I never give up. I don't quit. I will move mountains to get to an objective.
Well, so that's good. So what's the most courageous thing you have ever done?
Well, I would say, you know, starting a software company is probably the most courageous thing I've ever done. I had a great job at that time. I was, you know, on a fast track within the organization I was working in, and literally went to work in a garage to start a company on a platform that really was brand new and in a market that hadn't evolved yet. You know, I'm talking about the PC. I think that was probably the most courageous thing. I could tell you a variety of stories about just the startup of that company sometimes entertaining, but at the time were a little scary.
100%, Jacques. I think you continued it all the way. Even your little description of Todd sounds to me much more futuristic than what's currently been seen in the marketplace as well. So yeah, please be more courageous so that we will get more products out of you. Jock, if you could be anywhere else right now, where would it be?
Wow. Well, you know, I'm a workaholic, so I love what I do, and I'm fortunate that way. But if I could be anywhere else, I think it would be on the water somewhere, sailing.
Okay. What was your best subject in school?
Well, interesting. In high school, it was music. Because I was a musician, actually a professional musician before I was, before I really started, the career I have today, but mathematics, was also, my best subject. And in fact, as I moved up into more and more complex math, it became oddly easier, which wasn't intuitive to me at the time. And, something I actually worried about as I started, you know, taking math in college, by the time I got to calculus, it was I was having a lot of fun with it.
My God, I think you are like my eldest son, who just likes the complex stuff. The more you get into complex, the more you enjoy the complex stuff. Jock, music, professional musician. How did it all begin? And do you still play music when in the pastime?
So it started for me in 7th grade, and I had a wonderful music instructor, and you know, there's also some music history in my family. I had an uncle who had a PhD in music, but I started playing in the school, you know, band, met some guys, I picked up the guitar, and over time we formed a band and we started playing, you know, backyard parties and then, you know, clubs and got a little bit of notoriety. I was actually thought that was a trajectory I was going to go on until the band broke up. And at that point I rethought, you know, really where I wanted to go and what I was going to do next. And I was in college at the time. And so ended up, assuming I was going to take a music major and move towards, you know, it's, you know, continue in that industry, and ended up finding out that I was really good at writing software.
Got it, Jock. But when the van broke down, Jock, did you get down and try to fix the van before you moved on, or
you just... You know, I think there's times when you know that it's just not going to work. I think that there's a lot of, you know, circumstances around it. I think that we're driven in part by personalities, driven in part by not really understanding the industry that we were in, for several of the guys I was playing with. And they were in part trying to fast track something that really couldn't be fast tracked. They made a decision to move on to one of them made a decision to move on to another band and took another one of our members. And, you know, neither band ended up succeeding, actually. But after spending so much time with guys, you know, 10, 12, 20 hours a day in environments where, you know, it's your isolated and whatnot, I think it's, it was obvious it wasn't going to get better.
So true, Jock, so true. I'm glad that you managed to find it out so early on in your career, to move on to something that actually being a fruitful decision, I think.
Well, you know, I mentioned that I've been very opportunistic, and I think that even to some extent the band was opportunistic, but, you know, falling into software development, you know, going to work for a software company that, you know, as a marketing intern, you know, those are all things that were very opportunistic along the way. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I think why AJ and I get on so well is that being able to make decisions quickly, make change quickly, and being flexible is a key to being successful.
Sure, true, Jock. I think if the listeners can get one thing out of this, in addition to SMA and Todd, is be opportunistic. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Jock, be an Olympic athlete, in what sport would you compete?
I'd run. I was good at running long distances. I started actually in high school running the hurdles, as one of the things you do in track and field is you take long runs. And I always was, the coach always found me running with his cross country guys and decided that that's what I would be better at doing. And so I've run a number of, you know, very long runs, and I think that's probably what I would do.
Do you run at home as well, Jock, around wherever you are?
I don't run as much as I used to. As you described earlier, you know, as you get a little older, your knees get a little angry when you run too much. But I do run. I do still work out on the treadmill. Try to do 3 miles. 5 days a week. And I walk. I definitely take long walks. Usually my wife and I do that after dinner.
Nice. If a genie granted you 3 wishes, what would you ask the genie for?
The first thing I would ask for is the end of this current challenge that the world is going through in terms of COVID. Let's get this behind us. I would ask for the opportunity to continue doing interesting things. Would be another, and I guess the last would be to make sure that my friends and family were cared for.
Yes, beautiful job, beautiful. So, if you could eat only 3 foods for the rest of your life, which foods would you choose?
Wow, that's a very interesting question. I guess I would say bread, broccoli, and beef.
Is it all bees for a reason, Jock?
No, not at all. I realized that actually after I said it.
It was pretty fluent as well, and it's very random. This is the randomest response that he got for this question. It's amazing. So, Jock, I have 2 doubts. Number one, why do superheroes wear their underwear outside their clothes?
You know, I've often wondered that myself. That's a great question. I think that I guess if you fly, you've got to get aerodynamic, and I suppose that the undergarments are more aerodynamic than the overgarments.
That's a very scientific response there, Jock. And would you rather live one life that lasts 1,000 years or live 10 lives that last 100 years each?
I think it'd be the former. I think one of the things that makes us better, makes our lives better, is the opportunity to take our experiences to the next thing we do. I oftentimes hear people say, I wish I could go back. And I've always said, I'm glad I can take what I learned and go forward. And I think that the opportunity to develop that much wisdom and that much experience would be a unique honor, and be able to carry forward. And I think part of the reason why I say that is that I've always pushed to be on the leading edge of technology. A lot of my peers, were not exposed to a lot of tech early on, and they certainly aren't necessarily tech savvy today. And I push myself constantly to assimilate new tech, whether it's software or electronics. And I think that the opportunity to see what the next 940 years bring would be awesome.
Wow, Jock, that's one of the most profound response for this question. Nice. So, Jock, who are the people who have been the most influential in your life and career so far?
So I would say my parents first. They had a incredible work ethic, and I'm sure that's where I got it from. I mentioned earlier I'm a workaholic, but it's really more I love what I do, and I think I got that love for work from my parents. You know, next I would have to say my wife. We've been married for 39 years, and you know, she is the North Star. You know, she's gives me perspective and objectivity. And anytime I'm, you know, I start fretting about something, having a conversation, you know, helps me get clarity on whatever that issue is when I, you know, talking to her. I mentioned that I was a musician, and the band director that I had, I was very fortunate. I had him both in junior high school and high school. Was what I would consider an incredible leader. I mean, if you think about taking 200 junior high kids and getting them to do anything in unison, and then to be actually good at doing it, and was I think a demonstration of leadership. And I've thought back on, you know, the experiences I had being part of the bands that he created. And I've used a lot of those lessons over the last, you know, 40 plus years to, as leadership and leading the teams that I've been responsible for. Simon Decker, you know, because he would imagine the most interesting things for software to do, and entrusted me to create it. And I think it was that's what gave me the opportunity to accomplish many of the things that I did, including trusting a 23-year-old kid who was still in college to lead a software development activity that was winner take all kind of an approach, and either we succeeded or we went out of business. I think something that helped shape and influence my career. And AJ for his ability to think differently and to be in the way he approaches strategy. You know, I thought of myself as fairly strategic before AJ and I started working together, and, you know, he raised the bar, in that and has created an environment that is unique. And I think that, allowed me to walk with him on this journey. And I've learned a lot working with AJ over the last year, 8 years.
Perfect. Looks like you're surrounded by lots of lovable people there, John. It's really inspiring. Jacques, we know that we are in this COVID crisis, as you rightly mentioned. What have you observed lately that reminded you people are kind?
You know, it's really been the SMA team. You know, on March 17th, we were celebrating St. Patrick's Day at the office, and the notice came out that everybody had, were safer at home, and we had to send everybody home right after that lunch that we had. And that next morning, we started on this journey that I talked about earlier around town halls and all the rest of that. But this team, instead of, you know, polarizing or having challenges or, you know, getting frustrated, they came together. We have a better community today than we did on March 17th. And they've looked out for each other. They've made sure that everybody on the team is okay, that, you know, that they have some level of contact, that there isn't, you know, that there, if there's a challenge, they've helped work through it. And it, you know, just proved to me that there's humanity, and I'm very, very proud of this team for what they did to make that happen.
Exactly, Jacques. And how did you and team came together in this COVID crisis, Jacques? And do you have a frequent virtual meetings, and how did it all work?
Yeah, so on March 18th, we decided we're going to do 2-a-day meetings. First off, we signed into an all-day meeting where we basically lower our speaker volume, mute our mics, and this way, if we maintain the hey you factor. If somebody needs to reach me, they can simply turn up the, you know, base unmic or unmute their mic and say, hey Jacques, you got a minute? I need to talk to you, and then we can take it offline in another room. So we're still all working in essence in the same virtual office that way. And then we do 2-a-day tag ups where they're themed.
You know, we chat a little bit about, you know, whether it's a particular artist, if it's our favorite food, you know, the thing we did over the weekend, you know, a hobby, a project, et cetera. And, it, you know, it creates a, that kind of water cooler effect that, you know, as everybody's walking into the office in the morning, that good morning. And at the end of the day, we do a tag up just to talk a little bit about the news of the day, things that might have happened. You know, again, that idea of people as they leave the office saying goodbye to everybody in the office, which was actually saying good morning and saying goodbye was one of the things that we culturally instilled in the office, because we wanted people to feel, we want people to feel welcome in the room. And, you know, and it's, we kind of view our conference rooms even as round tables, not rectangular tables where there's somebody sitting at the head of the table. Because we believe everybody has, a unique perspective and insights to contribute to you know, any problem we're trying to solve. So, you know, we've been doing those things. We've integrated the town halls into what we do. And I think that's helped us stay more connected. You know, I will tell you that, you know, Liz Stillman, Maureen Murphy, Melissa Miller have worked to find unique ways to get the team to gel a little bit in that regard. You know, whether it was a coloring project, that might sound silly, but everybody got it. You know, it was things that everybody could do and put everybody on the same playing field. So it got to be fun. You got to see people. You know, it's one thing when you have somebody who's got 40 years of experience talking about something, you know, to somebody who's just brand new. But when you take everybody out of their comfort zone with something that's fun, you'll find out there we've got all kinds of talent. And, you know, it reminds us as well that everybody has something important to contribute. And I think that's been part of this whole success we've had with creating the community at SMNA.
Wow, sounds like SMA is a great place to work there, Jacques. So I'm sure if anybody is looking for a role or something, please do contact Jacques. Looks like it's a fun place to be and also more impactful place. That's great, Jock. So, Jock, who is the kindest person you know?
I have to say my wife. And the reason for that, I'll give you a great example. When this COVID thing started, you know, as a kind of a retirement job, my wife runs a one of the small boutiques in Laguna, and they had to close the store. So she immediately took up cooking for some of the elderly people in our neighborhood, making sure that if they needed somebody to go to the store, she would run into the store for them. And these aren't people that are in and out of our home on a regular basis. They're people we wave to, you know, before COVID, there were people we wave to maybe stop and have a, you know, few minute conversation with, but she was concerned that they needed somebody to look after them. And she did that. And, you know, there was there's a vendor that she works with who lived by herself, and, you know, she was concerned that being by yourself like that would be challenging. So, you know, would make meals and have her come by and pick them up and things so that she had some human contact. You know, I think that it was, and there was, you know, the motivation was purely making sure that people that needed somebody to worry about them had somebody to worry about them. And I think that was a very kind thing to do.
Jacques, what's one kind or thoughtful thing someone did to you so far or recently?
So that's a great question. And this is something I'm humbled and honored by. You know, when we started thinking about bringing entertainment to the town hall meetings, you know, we were talking about a variety of different things we could do. And unprompted by me, AJ asked about having my son participate in this. My son is a professional dancer. He works on Broadway. He's done a number of shows. And as you know, the entertainment business writ large is shut down and there is no work for entertainers. And it gave Justin an opportunity, you know, a creative outlet, give him an opportunity to continue working. You know, he's taught us to dance. Has always had since his college days an interest in kinesiology and stretching and things like that. So we do stretching exercises with him, and he invented our town hall trivia and has done a phenomenal job with that, which has given him an opportunity to expand that, you know, entertaining virtually, and open the doors for him to be able to do that with others. And I'm very grateful for that. There was a lot of choices of entertainers that we could have brought to the engagement, and, you know, AJ thought of my son first, and I'm very grateful for that.
Wow. And is your son, is it Justin?
It is.
Is Justin going to be there for the town hall on the September 10th as well?
Yes. Yeah. He's going to be doing trivia there as well during that one.
Nice, York. So looking forward to that. And guys, please do join town hall. You have mini me of York doing trivia.
Yes.
That's brilliant. So York, what's the biggest lesson life has taught you?
You know, I think it is never ask anybody to do something you're unwilling to do yourself. I think as a leader, you can't ask people to do things that you wouldn't do. I have pushed teams to work very long hours, and I can tell you that I was there, even if the only thing I could contribute to what they were working on was bringing them coffee and ordering pizza, I was still there doing that side by side with them. And if I've asked somebody to travel over a holiday, if I've asked people, it's not because I haven't done it or would be unwilling to do it. I've actually done that myself, because if you make, I believe if you make a commitment to somebody in business, it's always clients. You have to honor those commitments, and there are times that means that things are going to be hard. You're going to have to set aside some things, some personal things to succeed, to help that client succeed. And I've done that throughout my career. But as a result, I'll ask people to do those things, because it's something I'm willing to do. And I think it's, I think that's the biggest lesson. If people know you're willing to do it, you garner their respect. If they think that you're sending them into the lion's jaws because you're afraid to do it yourself, you lose their respect. And I think that's a critical element of success.
Wow, John, super powerful, super powerful. Chuck, 40 plus years of career, as you rightly said, opportunistic, things were falling in place, and all you went and found the right opportunity. Looking back, what's one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
So I think it would be to develop a network. I learned that later in my career that, staying in contact with people, even after you've left, whether it's you've left that firm, you've completed the assignment, maintaining that network of people, as an engineer, that didn't come naturally to me. I lost some opportunity, I think, along the way, and I've reconnected with some people, afterwards, and gone back and reconnected with folks for a variety of different reasons, whether it's another engagement or simply thinking of them for a perspective on something and calling. And I realize that how important it is to maintain that network, because it's really what makes us stronger. It's not the individual by themselves, but their collective history, and people are a critical part of that.
So true, Jock. So true. Jock, if someone asked to be your intern and learn all that you know, what would you teach them?
So, that's an interesting question, because over the years I have mentored a number of people. That is something that I did naturally when I first started my career, and something I do deliberately now. And I think that the thing that I would teach, try to instill in them, is really two things: take risks and honor your commitments. Never quit. I think those are the key things. The ability to see something through, even if you're think about it this way: you're going to run a race, you're going to come in last. Don't quit. Finish the race, because you're going to learn a lot from that journey anyway that you'll take to the next race.
Wow, Jacques, so good. Jacques, What's the best piece of advice you have received and from whom?
So, as I mentioned, that you know, when we started the company, I was very technical. I was responsible for developing the software. And over time, you know, I would get out and demo the software to clients, and I got very good at doing that. But I resisted the notion of not measuring myself by what I accomplished personally. And Bruce Bartels pulled me aside one day and said, you know, we need you to do more of the field work. And I said, well, you know, I'm an engineer. I'm happiest when I can, at the end of the day, see that I've created something. And he asked me, you know, so do you think Bill Gates measures himself by how many lines of code he writes? Or does Steve Jobs measure himself by the number of lines of code he writes? And I said, of course not. And I think if this were a TV sitcom, you know, there'd be somebody in the cast saying, wait for it, because the light bulb came on. And it's really more important over time to start measuring yourself by what the team accomplishes and by what you and the environment you create for that team to succeed in than it is to measure your own individual accomplishments. And I think that's the best advice I'd ever gotten.
Very lucky, Jock, there. And I'm sure that transformed your career from there.
It definitely took it to the next level. That is for certain.
Yes, Jock. So, Jock, as you rightly said, you know, you've always been an entrepreneur by heart, you know, managed to build software, managed to build products, managed to be part of SMA as a COO. In addition to that, musician, sailor, you name it, Jock. So what's next for you?
So really what's next for me is to continue the journey we're on and work, you know, working with AJ to make Todd what it can be. We have huge aspirations for Todd and for what we want this platform to be in the market. And I think we're well on our way on the journey. I think we've done a lot of really smart things but we've got a lot of work left to do. And I'm excited about being an integral part of that.
Definitely, Jacques. Definitely looks like Todd is, as I mentioned, is the future tool for resource management in our industry. Jacques, finally, the website, Jacques, is www.smawins.com. And there you will also find information about Todd. Is that right? If the listeners needs to know more about SMA and Todd, is that one point website or is there anything else that you recommend?
No, that is the website. There's a lot of great information out there. We have, you know, videos on Todd and you know, kind of our philosophy behind the platform. But there's also, we have some brilliant associates that work at the firm, and they have been inspired to contribute white papers and opinion pieces. There's, you know, I don't know, close to 100 of them out on the website. And I, you know, I would encourage folks just to even look at that. You know, there's a lot of great information. And of course, sign up for Todd. It's a great tool, whether you're talent or you're looking for talent, you know, engage the platform. I think you'll have fun with it. And I think as well, you'll get some great insights about either yourself, your career. You'll be able to, you know, catalog your experience, or you'll be able to find some amazing talent.
And it's free.
Yeah, exactly. And it's free.
Yes, Jock. So thank you so much, Jock, for sharing your time with us today. So it's been an absolute privilege to have you with us at Scribble Talk SMA exclusive. So wish you all the good health and happiness, and please do continue to inspire everybody around you. Good luck with Todd, and we will share all the details regarding SMA and Todd in this episode. So stay safe, stay healthy, stay kind. Thank you so much, Jock.
And Bhaskar, thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure to spend this time with you, and certainly to get to know you now and before. So thank you.
Thank you, Jock.
To our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. Please visit batchuscribble.com/podcast to listen to this episode and check out any of our other previously recorded episodes. If you've enjoyed today's interview, don't forget to subscribe, review, and share the Scribble Talk podcast. We hope you'll check out our next episode where we interview another industry expert and special guest. Until then, it's Ashley Kays.
Pascal Syndrome.
Signing off.